Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We're doing some bye week Baltimore Positive, some bonus Baltimore Positive. I got Don Moeller in the home studio with the Christmas leg lamp. And you know, when we designed Baltimore Positive 9 months ago, we said we're going to tell stories. And I got in the elevator, and the folks around my condo association said, you got to have Mike Sipe on a show. And within 20 minutes, Don, you said to me, I just booked Mike Sipe on a show. And I think we all saw the Dan Roderick's piece a couple weeks ago in the Baltimore Sun on that. Speak to Mike in your background. Let's welcome him in here.
Hey, Mike, how are you? How you doing?
I'm good, Don. Sir, hope you guys are doing well.
We are. Full disclosure, Nestor, Mike has schooled me once or twice on a golf course. And you're going to get back into it, right, Mike? We're going back out?
I am. I've been out twice. Trying to test the shoulders, make sure that they still work.
Well, you're carrying half the city, from what I understand. So, I mean, I'm really here to tell your story after reading it and having neighbors of mine say that, you know, you're a guy that's run for elected office, and you're a guy that's made changes, you know, where I sometimes say losing can be winning. I mean, you've managed to make a lot of change in this city.
You've been involved, Mike, as Nestor said, you've been involved in this housing thing for a long time, deputy, commissioner. Talk to us. Give us a historical, because one of the things we like to do, we said in the beginning, we're going to get smart people. We're going to help people really learn about how to make a difference in the city. Give us a little bit of your background and this journey that's gotten you to this point.
Right. So, actually, I started at the sort of footsteps of my dad, who was heavily involved in the anti-block busting campaign in the 1960s, trying to ensure that the neighborhood we were growing up with desegregated or integrated in a manner which preserved the neighborhood and kept slum landlords from buying up the community and forcing people out. And from there, I went to work as a community organizer, first in the Remington, Hamden area in the city, and then down in South Baltimore. And what I discovered in that process was the importance of housing on the stability of folks' lives, and also the ability to use housing as a way of creating wealth within the family. And that set me off on a journey of learning more about the housing industry and how the housing industry impacted our neighborhoods here in the city, and how we could fix some of the broken things and improve on the things that were somewhat working and bring new things into our neighborhoods. So it's been a 50-year journey, basically, and I'm now working in 7 neighborhoods in southwest Baltimore, just west of Martin Luther King, and fairly diverse neighborhoods with lots of great things going on. I always like to say, in Baltimore City, for every one bad thing that the Sun paper reports on the front page, they missed 10 great things that happened on that same day.
Well, thus Baltimore Positive was born, Mike. So, you know, having folks like you here, when you're saying all of these things that are happening, there would be a narrative that nothing good ever happens in Baltimore, that it's only gone downhill. And you've been a part of this for 50 years trying to build up places. Give us some success stories. Give us 2 or 3 things that maybe my audience doesn't know about. Maybe you bragged about it somewhere along the line, but give us a couple of your success stories that say, I took something from here and now it's there, and there's a much better place.
I think one of the best examples of how the city of Baltimore and neighborhoods came together and created something really exciting and positive is in a neighborhood called Franklin Square, which is over off of Cary Streets and Baltimore Street. And I was the project manager there for a number of years. We were able to take very beautiful housing that had gone vacant through a variety of disinvestment activities, and we created a whole variety of housing there. We created a limited equity co-op in the 100 block of North Carey Street, which is, I think, one of the most beautiful examples of preservation of old 19th century housing that benefited folks in that neighborhood. We were able to take the brownstones, the only real block of New York brownstones that were built in the city of Baltimore that still exists. There are 5,000 square foot mansions at one time, and we built condominiums in there that were market rate condominiums. And then a block up, we preserved both sides of the 1500 block of West Fayette Street and made that affordable rental housing.
When did you, what was, give us a time frame on that, Mike. What's the time frame?
Land, we brought into the city the first modular housing that was trucked in, plunked down on the lots, and then sold to working class families in that neighborhood. So you had a whole mix of what was going on economically in Franklin Square, from affordable rental to market rate rental, market rate home ownership. And that was in the 80s. Today, it's still there. It's a great example of how you can have a public-private partnership that can anchor a neighborhood and stop the disinvestment and the bleeding that had been going on for generations.
But this starts with money, you know, whether it's federal money, state money, city money, or private money. And we hear so much about private equity. We hear about investment. Investment doesn't mean the taxpayer's investing it. It means there's money that's coming from the outside. In getting these projects done, where do you start? Where do you go from community organizer to getting businesses and people with resources to come in and say, I'm going to make that investment in West Baltimore?
So it really starts with sort of a grassroots effort, door to door, knocking on those doors, getting the residents of that neighborhood engaged in developing a vision for what they would like to see their neighborhood become. And the first thing we have to recognize is that in some of these neighborhoods, you know, one in the seven neighborhoods I'm working in, Mount Clair, which used to be home to many of the railroad workers in the 19th and 20th century, has gone through four generations of disinvestment. So you're not going to change it overnight. But if you don't have a vision plan that the residents of that neighborhood create, then you don't have a roadmap of where you want to be or how you want to be. And then you take that vision plan and basically you become a salesman. I mean, you market that. You market that to the public sector and the private sector and say, look, guys, if we can put together these resources, this is what's going to happen in this neighborhood. And from a salesman position, and Don, you know this from your years in public service, if we turn around and stabilize the neighborhood, it actually the investment, the public investment of taxpayers' dollars means that over the next 25 years, that municipality is going to spend a lot less money on a daily basis and have more cash flow coming in from property taxes, income tax, piggyback tax, sales tax than they had prior to that. So it's actually a good investment.
So, Mike, go ahead. I'm sorry.
The public sector joins with the private sector to invest in a neighborhood.
So, Mike, in 2012, after this really long and successful career in trying to make this happen in a variety of capacities, you come back. I guess you get asked to come back and head up this Southwest partnership. You say, hey, I've got a little more left in me. And now you're working in these seven neighborhoods. Describe for people that did not read the Dan Roderick's articles or have not heard about your effort. Tell people what you're doing in the Southwest Partnership.
Right. So, the Southwest Partnership really is a citizen-driven organization. The board of directors that governs it and establishes policy is made up of primarily residents of the neighborhood and the six anchor institutions that reside in those neighborhoods, like the University of Maryland Baltimore and Bon Secours Hospital. And we focus on seven areas of community development. We have we focus on reclaiming the vacant houses. We focus on bringing small business back to the neighborhood, public safety, education, which in my mind is probably the linchpin. If we can show that we have K-8 schools that are producing a quality product, we're going to keep people in the neighborhoods. Then we do sort of quality of life things, planting trees. We have three different urban farming projects going in the community. And then the last is workforce development. I mean, sadly, in a couple of our neighborhoods, the unemployment rate is in excess of 28%. So we're really engaged with those citizens that right now are not in the mainstream economic system and trying to wed them to jobs that are going to give them a career path that will allow them to take care of their family.
Are many of those people, have they been incarcerated at some point, and part of the 28% is, I don't want to say unhirable, but difficult to hire and difficult to place in that way? Or is that not accurate?
So a little over 30% are men who are coming back to the community from incarceration.
30%. Wow. Okay.
Right. Then
three in every 10 residents in the neighborhood is coming back out of the system, correct?
Correct.
So, Mike, go ahead.
Yeah, then there's a whole nother population there that of young people who may have had some run-ins with the law, but they haven't been incarcerated. And we've really, as a society or in a community, we've failed them because we haven't been able to give them a sense of their own future. And so what our workforce development program tries to do is to reach out to those 16 to 25-year-olds and say, yeah, there is a future. There is a growth in the construction industry. There's a growth in the health industry. There's a growth in arts and entertainment. And there's a place in there for you if we can get you through these hurdles. And the important thing is to recognize that you're going to fail 80% of the time with these guys for three or four tries. But at the fifth try or the sixth try where you actually reach a point where they get it and they want to invest the time and energy in creating a future for themselves.
Mike Sipe is our guest. You can find all of their work out at the Southwest Partnership at southwestpartnershipbaltimore.org. Dan Rodericks wrote it about it a couple of weeks ago. I've had friends and neighbors telling me about Mike's work. And Don, comes honest for you. You've known Mike a long time.
I've known Mike a long time and been aware of his work. Mike, I always said, and I forget exactly what capacity you were working in, but early in the Jim Smith administration, I remember you were involved in a project in Lansdowne that provided affordable housing for folks. And it's so timely right now where County Executive Ushefsky, again, is trying to talk to people about the importance, really, of trying to provide affordable housing opportunities for folks. And it's hard for me to imagine that in 2019 we're still having a debate as to whether or not someone on a housing voucher should have that voucher considered as income. It seems so short-sighted to me to not consider that. But we were talking this morning with Senator Bill Ferguson, and we're talking about your project way back then in Lansdowne, and I said, one of the things that stood out back there, Mike, and I want you to talk about it a little bit, is about how well run that project was, how clean it was, how crime-free it was. And the senator's point was, it's all about the management and the commitment. Talk a little bit about that back even in those Lansdowne days and that concept that it can be done.
Yeah, so the Lansdowne development was an apartment complex that had been built with a federal subsidy years ago, and the owner had basically let it run down I was working for a nonprofit then that was in the business of trying to bring back affordable housing that was on the verge of going off the market. And we were fortunate to be able to buy that property and work with Jim Smith's folks in housing and planning and create an environment there where people wanted to come to live. And it started with the built environment. How can we redesign that complex so it became more of a community and less than just, well, that's where I, you know, rent 800 square feet. But the other thing is we recognize that the folks coming in that we were going to house and the existing families that were there had some significant personal hurdles that they had to get through. So in every complex that we built out during that time period of my life, and it was over 1,000 units, we made sure that the cash flow coming out of those developments supported an infrastructure of services on site so that we could both provide the support a mom or a dad needed to get back into the workforce, or if there was a personal crisis in the family, which we knew was going to lead to unemployment, you know, it might be an injury, it might be a divorce, might be a terminal illness within the family, but that we could intervene immediately with those families and help maintain that stability, particularly economically in the family. And then lastly, for us, it was really important that the education of the kids didn't end at 3 o'clock when the last bell rang. So after we ran after-school programs, weekend programs, summer programs for the kids to keep them engaged, and I'm not sure they realized it, but those programs were really educational programs. We tried to make them not look educational, but they were. And I think that's what made those developments successful.
Mike, I took a little look at your background. I mean, you've done so much work with homeless folks, veterans. You know, I moved downtown 16 years ago, and there was a homeless man living on the corner. And 16 years later, he's still there every day. I remember a time 10 or 12 years ago, I bristled at that, and now I don't know what to say or do or what the government does about that or what a city can do about that. I've lived here long enough to remember when there weren't folks at the foot of bridges holding up signs in our city or using the city in that sort of transient way. I know you've been all over the city. Speak to that a little bit about the homelessness issue and things that you've seen and how we could have such a thing. I saw a veteran, literally, I walked up Charles Street about 3 days ago. I had a guy who was a veteran, had a sign, said, I'm a homeless veteran. How does that happen in America in 2019?
Yeah, well, the sad part about our veterans is if you look at the homeless population nationally, the single highest percentage of a demographic in our homeless population, male population, are veterans. And when I was in running a program for homeless vets, which I did for 10 years.
I know you did. I want to make sure that everybody knows about that.
Pardon me?
I know you did. I want to make sure everybody knows about that.
Right.
It's incredible work. It really is.
And it's a great program. I mean, I can't take credit for the design of the program. There was a gentleman by the name of Woody Curry that designed it. I just made sure it stayed afloat. But we just saw so many young vets coming back from Afghanistan, Iraq, and even Vietnam vets who were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder that had never been adequately treated within the VA system. And post-traumatic stress disorder is a devastating illness. It can ruin your life, and it can ruin your relationships with your wife, your mother, your father, your siblings. And eventually, if it's not treated, you're going to treat it yourself, and you're going to self-medicate. And that's why we have so many homeless vets roaming our streets. But to your other question, which I think weighs on Baltimore more and more every day, is if you went out and talked to those guys that are on MLK, North Avenue, President Street, they're panhandling. Majority of them are young white guys. They're not Baltimore born and raised. These guys are coming into Baltimore City because they ended up destroying their relationships where they are coming from. So we have a couple at MLK over by Baltimore, between Baltimore and Lombard. And they're almost all Western Maryland, West Virginia, and Southern Pennsylvania, born and raised. But because they're have a serious addiction issue that's not being treated, and because they've torn apart the fabric of their relationships with their peers and their families, they end up migrating to Baltimore. One, because the drugs are cheaper here, and two, because it's in a big city, you can disappear when you need to, and so. We are attracting from across the region this population of young addicted, opioid addicted men. And
you've just explained a lot to me, by the way, because I drive around the city and that
you see this.
I absolutely see this. The lean, the whole deal, and. You know, we don't all get out of the car and say, hey, buddy, where are you from? Tell me your story. That you've spent a life, hey, buddy, tell me your story, right? Literally.
Right. I mean, and these guys, I mean, they can look frightening, I guess, to some people. But, I mean, one of the great things about the work that I do for me is I actually get to engage these guys because they're impacting the quality of life of the neighbors I'm going to turn around. Arresting them is not the answer. So you have to find out who they are, and, you know, what can we do in our seven neighborhoods to, one, get them the assistance they need or help they need, and two, to make it difficult for them to be there.
Mike, you've been at this a long time, doing great work. Quick question, 10 or 15 years from now, you look at the seven neighborhoods that Southwest Partnership has focused on, is trying to make. How do you judge the success of those seven neighborhoods 10 or 15 years down the road? What do you want to see?
Well, from the physical side, in 15 years, there won't be one vacant house in any of the seven neighborhoods.
Wow.
There'll be a vibrant retail district along Washington Boulevard and along West Baltimore Street that is providing the services to enhance the quality of life for the residents. And I think most importantly, and I think we're very close to actually achieving this, is we have got some young, incredibly dynamic principals that are coming into our schools down here that are changing the nature of those schools. And I think it's incredibly important that in 15 years, and hopefully much earlier than 15 years, the residents of all seven neighborhoods are comfortable saying, I'm going to send my kid to George Washington, or I'm going to send my kid to Stuart Hill or to Franklin Square, because I know the leadership in that school is going to ensure my kid gets a great education.
We've spent a lot of time, Mike. Nestor's becoming a true expert on Kerwin. It is all connected. One of the things, Nestor, what I want to say to our listeners and the folks on the podcast, folks watching on Facebook, is Mike Sipe is one of those people that we talked about at the beginning of Baltimore Positive. There are lots of Mike Sipes out there doing great work. And, Mike, I just want to say thank you very much for your commitment to the city. Thanks for believing.
Oh, you got to believe. Baltimore is a great city. and we have great neighborhoods, and we have great people. And if we're ending this, Nestor, I just wanted to let you know that one of the things that I have aspired in my life to be is somebody who can hit a golf ball as far as Don Mueller does.
Well, that was Don Mueller, the earlier version. We'll get out and see who can
you
hit it.
You just need to get a bigger club, you know, and get one of those balls where it cheats and it goes further, you know. Yeah. Baseball has them every night.
Can't wait to catch up, Mike. Thanks for all your great work.
Mike Seif joining us here. He is Southwest Partnership, Baltimore.org. You can learn more about everything they're doing there. Bear Circle, Franklin Square, Holland's Roundhouse, Mount Clair, Pigtown, Poppleton, and Union Square. Learn about all the stuff they're doing over at Holland Street and making just right out my window, just like I can walk over there.
Making the city better there. Block by block.
I love it. Baltimore Positive, Don Mueller and I doing bonus bi-week Baltimore Positive coverage. We are Baltimore Positive and WNST.net, AM 1570 at WNST Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking Baltimore Positive.